Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We're also happy here to have back on the program once again Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here on a Monday, and we open it up to whatever questions you might have, healthcare questions. We occasionally on the program talked with various kinds of specialists, but a long time ago we thought maybe it would be good to have somebody who can answer a I'm sorry, he's toying with his headphone cord that's all goofed up here. A long time ago, we decided that it was maybe it would be a good idea to have somebody who could answer a wide range of questions, and he sees people of all ages in his practice. He sees children, he sees grown-ups, people who have a wide range of questions and problems, and we thought, well, maybe it'd be a good idea to have a kind of a general guy here, and he said yes, he would do that. He's been doing that for quite a while for us. So if you have questions, give us a call. It could be for grown-ups, could be for kids, could be, you know, whatever concerns you might have. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point, you can certainly call us. Keep in mind, we cannot do diagnosis over the phone because the doctor can't see you, but I know he'll do his best to answer your questions. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Well, thank you, David. I'm glad to be back. And as you noticed as I was fiddling with my cord, it's a good thing we're on radio and not television.
Well, we might have provided people with just the tiniest bit of entertainment. That's many times around here. Let me tell you, it's good that people cannot see us. That is very good. Flu shots, can you still get one? And
you
is
bet.
It still okay?
It is not too late to get a flu shot, and it's still very important to emphasize the benefits of people getting flu shots. In fact, the formal recommendations over the last few years have been expanded to include more and more individuals who are, in fact, recommended to get flu shots. So for kids, 6 months to 18 years of age, which is an expansion, all pregnant women should be getting flu shots. And the old recommendations that people were aware of, probably anybody who has any type of serious chronic medical disease, especially heart, lung disease, or diabetes, should be getting them. The previous recommendations were for individuals over the age of 65, and that's now been lowered to age 50. Mm-hmm. So there is a very, very large group of people who are now recommended to be getting flu shots on a regular basis, and they have been shown to be very, very effective in reducing the degree of illness and, in particular, death, especially in the very young and the very old. So it's still a very, very good idea.
Okay. And once you get the shot, how long does it take for the immunity to develop?
It really will take several weeks, which is why we try to get the flu shot program started before we get into the heart of the flu season. Mm-hmm. But as long as you haven't gotten the flu yet, it's still appropriate to go ahead and get immunized.
All right. We have a caller here. Let's get right to him. Someone who is calling us from Effingham and on our line one right here. Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about food allergies. I was wondering what the latest research is on food allergies and their effect on the immune system and cognitive functioning, and how effective are the RAS tests?
You hit a very broad subject here. Food allergy testing is still probably one of the areas that is very difficult to test for accurately. The traditional testing has been skin testing, where a small amount of a substance is actually applied just underneath the surface of the skin, and then in a few minutes you come back and see what type of immune response the body generated to that. There hasn't always been a great correlation between the skin test results and people's response to ingesting those substances. So there are people who simply don't tolerate certain types of foods that may or may not be allergic in nature, and there are people who test positive for things that they otherwise eat with impunity. So in many instances, it's necessary to look at both testing and the actual clinical response of the individual to that substance in the course of their daily life. RAS testing is a blood test used to try and identify whether people might be allergic using a certain type of white blood cell. And these, too, can be used for general screening and can oftentimes be positive in situations where there both is and is not an allergic reaction clinically. So in most instances, any type of testing done for allergies has to be looked at in terms of the actual clinical situation for that particular patient. In most instances, the usual treatment is going to be avoid anything that you think you might potentially be allergic to. And if you can't avoid it, then try and block the allergic response, and there are a variety of medications that can be used for that. The other part of your question related to cognitive issues, and I'm not personally aware of a lot of information on this particular subject, so if you have a specific issue in that regard, I would try to find out some more for you, but I don't have a lot right now.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll go on here. Another caller here where we are in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about eye exams for diabetics. And if one goes to the typical places to get eyeglasses, you know, Lens Crafters, Sears, whatever, will that eye exam be adequate to be looking for changes in the diabetic's eyes, or should there be annual or six-month checkups by medical doctors instead? And I'll hang up and take the answer off the air.
As a general rule, an optometrist doing an eye exam should, in fact, be able to identify some of the blood vessel-related changes that occur in diabetic patients. What is called diabetic retinopathy is an abnormal proliferation of blood vessels in the back of the eye on the retina. These abnormal blood vessels can bleed and ultimately interfere with the retina's ability to focus light and therefore allow that individual to see normally. So diabetic retinopathy is one of the more feared complications of poorly controlled diabetes. Most diabetic complications have a proportionality related to how well your blood sugars have been controlled. When we look at diabetes in the big picture, we find out that it's really not the blood sugar that causes the long-term complications. What really happens is there are abnormalities that occur in blood vessels over a long period of time in a number of places around the body. But we don't have many ways to check out those blood vessels, so we use blood sugar as a stand-in. And a number of studies have shown that long-term good control of blood sugar results in fewer diabetic blood vessel complications. But in actuality, one of the few places where you can actually see blood vessels directly is, in fact, in the back of the eye. And so the diabetic eye exam is something that is very important to be done, because if there are blood vessel changes occurring there, they are probably occurring in other parts of the body as well that we can't directly visualize. So a diabetic eye exam is something that's very, very important for diabetic patients to have done on a regular basis, because it is one of the places where long-term complications will show up.
Just a general question on eyes. For people who would say that they think that their vision's fine, that they're not in need of any correction, is there a recommendation, though, about having some kind of periodic exam?
Yes, in the sense that as we get older, between the ages of 40 and 50 in particular, even if you see okay, it's probably a reasonable thing to do to get a eye exam every couple of years, because one of the parts of an eye exam is also to measure what's called intraocular pressure. An elevated pressure can be a sign of glaucoma, And glaucoma is actually another fairly common cause of visual loss. And there, unfortunately, aren't a whole lot of symptoms associated with that until you develop the visual loss, at which point it's starting to get a little late. So an eye exam every couple of years, starting somewhere in the 40 to 50 year range, even for individuals who otherwise have, quote, normal vision, is still probably a reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, and glaucoma is provided that you identify it early, it's very treatable.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here for this program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that whatever kind of healthcare questions you might have for yourself, for people in your family, could be for your kids, you can call us and he will do his best. Help you out. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Last week on the program, I was talking with a physician, I think really the reason we started out with this fellow was that we wanted to talk a little bit about the recent study that got some attention in the news, finding that even people who did not have elevated cholesterol levels might have some benefit by taking statins, by taking cholesterol-lowering medication. And one of the things that apparently emerged, and this was something that I guess is a thing that is new to me, is that the importance of knowing what someone's C-reactive protein level was. Because apparently in these people, they might not have had high cholesterol, but they had the high C-reactive protein, and that was an indicator of higher risk. And in fact, one of the things that this physician said, that in fact, high CRAP levels can be predictive of a lot of things. So that's the thing that might be good to know. Give us the 2-minute lecture on C-reactive protein and what it is.
Well, as you pointed out, we're getting out to the edge of what we sort of do know and what we don't know. Mm-hmm. Part of this derived from the fact that when the statin medications came out to help with cholesterol, which they definitely do, they also found that there was a benefit to individuals who were taking them and didn't even have particularly high cholesterol levels to begin with. CRP is one of several different blood tests that can be used to measure inflammation. And it's thought that inflammatory changes in the lining of blood vessels has a lot to do with the development of cardiovascular disease, in addition to all of the other known risk factors, the people who smoke, the people who have diabetes, the people who have high blood pressure, the elevated cholesterol, who are overweight, who don't exercise. Mm-hmm. All of those things have a bearing, but there is probably some role for inflammation there as well. And what was found with some earlier studies was that individuals who didn't have necessarily high cholesterol, but did have elevated CRPs, probably had cardiovascular benefit from taking statin medication, not because of additional drop in cholesterol, but probably because of its anti-inflammatory effect. Mm. And so the previous studies that said, gee, lowering your cholesterol with these medications lowered your cardiovascular risk, while that's true, we have to sort of ask ourselves how much of that benefit came from lowering their cholesterol and how much of that benefit came from lowering their CRP or inflammation in those blood vessel walls. So right now, it is recommended that for individuals who, say, have a family history of heart disease but don't have an elevated cholesterol, is to look at their CRP and find out, well, maybe you haven't inherited bad cholesterol, but maybe you have a tendency toward inflammatory changes that leads forward to your family history of heart disease. And so there is some discussion in the medical community to take those individuals who are at higher risk because of their family history, and even if their cholesterol is okay, try and lower the inflammation. Now, have we generalized that to, gee, everybody ought to have their CRP checked and go on medication if it's elevated? The answer is no, because there aren't any studies yet that say, you know, the long-term benefit of the medication is going to outweigh the potential long-term side effects of taking the medication.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I asked this doctor was this a particularly expensive test for CRP? And he said, no, not really. So I guess that would lead to the question, well, if would there be some particular reason or let us say, okay, so one reason for you to maybe request of the doctor to test that would be is if you have a strong family history of heart disease.
Correct.
Would there be any other particular reason for a patient to ask their doctor, you know, do you think that it would be a good idea for as long as we're doing a standard blood thing and you're going to test my cholesterol and maybe you test my blood sugar and a bunch of other stuff, that it would be good to do this?
Well, the follow-up question to that is, okay, it comes back elevated. What are you as a patient going to do about that? And at the moment, what we have is, okay, we can put you on statin medications forever.
Mm-hmm. So doing those other things, all the lifestyle stuff,
right?
Will that if you have an elevated CRP, if you do those other things, the same things that you would say would be good to do if you had high cholesterol, mm-hmm. will that also affect your CRP?
Yes. And the question is how much, and is that enough? And the answer yet is not known.
Okay. We have some other folks who have questions, and let us talk next with someone in Champaign. And this would be line one. Hello.
Actually, I was going to ask you about CPR, so you really answered a lot of the questions I have. But I'm an older lady, and I have arthritis. And my cholesterol appears to be pretty much in line and blood pressure and everything. But is there any dietary things or anything that, I mean, without knowing, my understanding is it's very possible that a lot of arthritis is also triggered because of a high inflammatory rate.
You are correct, and that's one of the things that has to be taken into consideration when the test is done. Because the CRP is, in fact, elevated with any type of inflammatory response within the body. It is not specific for any particular disease process. So if you have active arthritis, you have active joint inflammation, your CRP will, in fact, be elevated. Now, whether that's a cardiovascular risk, because it's up because of your arthritis, isn't known yet. If you have any type of infectious process going on, your CRP will be elevated because inflammation is part of our immune response. So there are a number of situations where, separate from cardiovascular disease, your CRP will in fact be elevated. So as with all test results, it has to be interpreted in light of that particular individual's current medical condition. And in some instances, people who have chronic arthritis, their CRP is never normal because they have ongoing inflammation in their joints. And so it becomes very, very difficult to then utilize that test for cardiovascular purposes when it's never normal to begin with.
Well, it sounds like there's going to be a new adventure with CRP, doesn't it?
Oh, there's always a new adventure in medicine.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Mattoon. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to check first and make sure it's appropriate that I ask a question about Alzheimer's disease.
Sure.
Okay. If you had someone close to you that you suspected might have Alzheimer's disease or something related, and you had only noticed quirky behavior, what would you be looking for?
Medically speaking or just as a family member?
Okay. If it was a person who was adamantly opposed to getting any medical kind of attention and you wanted to observe and make sure that, basically if you were a family member trying to decide when it's time to really intervene and maybe be a lot more forceful about seeing a physician.
Okay. Personally, I think it's important for family members to intervene, to be more insistent upon that medical evaluation if, in fact, the observed person's behavior is now a potential threat to either their or others' well-being. There are people who should not be driving cars. They just shouldn't be out there. They could harm themselves. They could harm others. There are people who should not be left alone at home because they leave the gas stove on and forget to turn it off. When there are issues of safety, I don't think it's really optional anymore in terms of an evaluation. The person who says, gee, you know, I'm a little forgetful, but I can do all my daily activities. I can, you know, go to the grocery store. I can find my way home. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to go through a big medical evaluation. You can probably just, you know, provide them with the help and the support that they need to do their daily activities and wait and see how things go. There are a few things that are perhaps, quote, normal age-related changes. Most of us find that, you know, our memory for names and faces and things, it gets a little harder to bring it up as quickly as we would like. We sometimes search for that word that is on the tip of our tongue and can't remember it. And some of those things are fairly normal. But if somebody is having trouble doing their daily activities, or if they are, you know, in a situation where they could potentially harm themselves or others, then it's time to get that investigated.
Are there any physiological signs that a layperson would see that indicates somebody has Alzheimer's?
Generally not, other than the difficulty with short-term memory. One of the more common things with folks who develop Alzheimer's is that they can tell you what they did 50 years ago, but they can't tell you what they did this morning. And in many instances, a very simple test often done is to simply give somebody three things to remember and tell them, you know, I'm going to come back in 5 minutes and I'm going to ask you what these three things are. And, you know, most people whose short-term memory isn't impaired can remember three things for 5 minutes. And those who have a significant problem really don't. And it's often surprising to find out, you know, who really can't do that.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have someone else in Mattoon. This is our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that a person with an egg allergy can't get a flu shot yet.
That
I understand
is correct.
That there are cases where as a person ages, the allergy problem seems to lessen. And I wonder if a person gets in their upper 70s, early 80s, whether that's true. Would it be chancy to get a flu shot? Or I'm just wondering why they can't make flu shots to take care of this problem, because I can get a pneumonia shot.
Right. The flu virus is incubated in chicken eggs to basically grow it, and egg protein ends up in the final product. And folks who are truly significantly allergic to eggs can potentially react to the flu shot. The amount of egg protein is less in the nasal spray that is used as a substitute for the flu shot, but there is still some present. So currently, unless you had some type of formal allergy evaluation to try and, as much as possible, try and eliminate any ongoing egg allergy, it's not currently recommended for folks with a significant egg sensitivity to get a flu shot. In those households, what we normally recommend is making sure that everybody else gets their flu shot. One of the things that we sometimes rely upon in terms of the overall population is a concept referred to as herd immunity. If you immunize generally about 80% of the population, the remaining 20% is usually, if they're equally distributed, surrounded by people who aren't going to get the flu. So there's nobody for them to contract it from. So basically, if we have somebody with a significant egg allergy, we would encourage their family to be immunized to reduce the risk of them bringing it home to that individual.
I understand that, but I was just curious. I had heard at one time that they were trying to make a flu shot that wouldn't be, you know, part of the egg allergy, but I guess the nasal spray is the closest thing then.
Correct.
Anything about the aging and less problem with allergies?
That is generally true, simply as it reflects a decline in the immune system overall. But whether you could rely on that to say I'm no longer allergic to eggs is really open to debate and would need to be formally tested in that given individual.
A test wouldn't show?
It would potentially help give additional information. Yes, you could get formally tested for egg allergy again.
To see if it'd be less?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. I got his name written down right here. So I remember his family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is here every other month. We talk about health, and it's a general kind of program. So whatever questions you might have, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, Farmer City, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about Alzheimer's. I had a question about how you differentiate between Alzheimer's and other kinds of dementias. And I also wanted to know how long the early stages of Alzheimer's can last with treatment. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. This is a very good question, because the larger issue is what we would medically refer to is dementia. Now, people who become demented, the majority of them probably, in fact, ultimately turn out to have Alzheimer's. The only definitive way that you can make that diagnosis is with pathologic tissue obtained from the brain. So this is usually a post-mortem diagnosis or conclusion. Prior to death, there really isn't any definitive way to say this is Alzheimer's. There are other types of dementing illnesses that usually have different types of characteristics in terms of the history that the patient or the family presents and their physical findings. But in fact, if a patient comes in and there's concerns about dementia, there is a fairly standard medical evaluation that should take place, because in probably 15% of cases, if you start with a broad group of demented individuals, you'll find some underlying medical reason which, if treated, does in fact make that person better. And we're talking about somebody who is severely depressed, may look demented. We find that individuals who have significantly underactive thyroids can act demented. So there are some basic standard medical things that need to be looked at and at least taken off the table in terms of consideration before saying, well, you know, they're just demented and that's the way it is. We usually include some type of scanning of the brain as part of this evaluation that takes out of the picture really, really rare things like tumors, the effects of old strokes. There are a number of things that can potentially masquerade as, quote, Alzheimer's. So if you go through that basic medical evaluation, you've taken out the 15% of treatable dementias, then you're left with that much larger majority of population of some type of dementia that you're really not going to be able to cure, make go away. Within that subset of that 85%, the vast majority of these are going to turn out to be Alzheimer's. There are medications that can be prescribed to patients with both early and moderate dementia that can help maintain their cognitive function. How long that will last, how much benefit you can get from that, no real way to predict. It's very much an individual response. The early stages of dementia can last anywhere from months to years. The worst case for Alzheimer's patients are those who rapidly decline. They lose their cognitive function, and pretty soon their physical condition declines as well. But there are other individuals who have gone on for years, if not a decade or more, with things like Alzheimer's. And there really isn't a good way to predict the time sequence or course for a given individual other than observing the rate at which things seem to progress. Yeah.
We have some other folks here. I'm glad that we actually got into this area. One of the things that I had just thought about mentioning, perhaps people have seen recent results of a study that had been done looking at the supplement, the over-the-counter supplement Ginkgo biloba, that has been promoted as something that improves brain functioning. And apparently they did a pretty significant study taking a look at people with Alzheimer's disease, looking at this question, might this help their functioning? And apparently the answer that the study came up with was no, it doesn't. And which then just leads me to ask the question, aside from the kind of medications that you talked about that are prescription medications, so you have to go up to the doctor, is there anything else that seems to have been found to be helpful?
There are some interesting statistical differences between individuals with Alzheimer's and those who don't seem to get it. There are certain forms of Alzheimer's disease that run in families, and there probably are some underlying genetic tendencies that somebody can inherit. It's not certainly well understood at this point. But the majority of cases of Alzheimer's seem to occur in individuals where there's no particularly strong family history of dementing illnesses. And some of the things that have been associated with lesser incidence of Alzheimer's are physical activity. People who remain physically active seem to have less likelihood of developing Alzheimer's. People who remain mentally active seem to develop less Alzheimer's. People who are engaged in strong social relationships seem to have fewer incidences of Alzheimer's. So there are a number of things that have nothing to do with medication that can influence the development here, but as to sort of why and how, that's really not well understood right now. In terms of some type of over-the-counter supplement, herb, whatever, no, I'm not aware of anything that has been definitively shown to be beneficial.
Right. Next caller is in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a question about the flu vaccination and the one question is someone has never had a flu vaccine ever, is there any way you would go about getting one differently? Do you have to have it done twice or anything like that?
For adults, no. You simply go ahead and get your flu shot.
Oh, okay. So for an adult, it's fine.
Right. For kids, we do usually recommend, if they've never been exposed to it before, that they get a second shot a month later.
I see. And then do you have any thoughts about the nasal spray versus the injection? Or is there any literature or any indication that one works better than the other? What are your thoughts about that?
Actually, they're quite comparable in terms of their efficacy. The nasal spray may actually turn out to be a little bit more effective than the flu shot. Mm-hmm. Folks who, are pathologically afraid of shots, I think the nasal spray is a real reasonable alternative. The downside potentially to the nasal spray is the fact that it uses what's called an attenuated virus. So it's a weakened flu virus, but not a killed virus. Uh-huh. The flu shot uses a killed virus. So that's why we can pretty much say you will not get the flu from your flu shot. Now, you may have a reaction to the injection. Your immune system may generate a pretty healthy response, but you are not going to get the flu. The nasal spray has a small potential risk, because it's just a weakened virus, of then being spread from the person who got the nasal spray to someone who is immunocompromised. Okay, so we generally don't recommend giving the nasal spray to somebody whose immune system is down or who will be coming in contact
with those
with somebody whose immune system is down.
Oh, okay. But other than that caveat, it works as well.
Yes, very much.
Okay, well, thanks for your help.
Okay, very good. And the next caller we will talk with, this is also someone in Champaign on line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I also had questions about the nasal spray flu vaccine. One was, I wondered if you could have it if you are taking like a Flonase-type nasal spray, and also if why there was an age limit on it. I think it's set up to 50 years old.
Right. The nasal spray, I believe, is marketed to individuals 2 years of age up to age 50, and in most instances, it simply represents the limits of what the testing was done. Not that suddenly at age 51 that it doesn't work. It just wasn't tested in that group, and consequently they don't have FDA approval to market it to that group. The nasal spray was primarily targeted at individuals who didn't like shots, and you know, that was mostly the younger population. So my suspicion is that's why we have that age range on it. The I forgot the other part of your...
If you're using Flonase
Not a problem. In fact, in order for the flu nasal spray to be effective, you got to basically be able to get it into your nose. So anything that you're doing to keep your nasal passages open on a chronic basis is fine.
Okay.
So that's not a problem.
All right. Thank you. To Mattoon next, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering about pernicious anemia. My grandfather died of it, and I wondered if it could be inherited.
Generally, no, that's not an inherited illness. Pernicious anemia is the result of a deficiency in vitamin B12. And this is something that, if someone is anemic, can be easily tested for with a blood test for their B12 levels. And if present, replacement of the B12 is something that will fix the anemia.
It's usually a shot that's most effective, right? Not the pills.
It's much easier to get B12 into somebody with a shot than taking it orally, yes.
I had another question about iron-free supplements, multivitamins.
Mm-hmm.
At an age, it says that you don't need iron when you're past 70s. And I wondered if, knowing that my grandfather had anemia, I wondered if not having iron in the supplements is good or not.
The B12 deficiency and iron deficiency are two entirely separate medical problems, both of which can ultimately make you anemic. And that's where the blood tests done to figure out what kind of anemia you have are very, very important. If you don't have any type of iron deficiency, then you really don't need a supplement that contains iron. Women who are of menstruating age typically are losing blood and iron on a regular basis, and oftentimes their multivitamins do have some extra iron in it, but after menopause, when you don't have that blood loss anymore, the addition of the extra iron is usually not necessary.
Oh, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. We'll come here next to someone in Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I just heard about a study that was done in the academic community about the herd effect particularly, and it seemed like it's a no-brainer to get a flu shot in this community. But a friend of mine said he had heard a short snippet on one of these soundbite-oriented local casts about medical, and they said that seniors might benefit from a double dose or a reinforcing dose. I don't know which it was, really. Have you heard anything about that?
For the flu shot?
Yes.
No, I have not.
Well, I wasn't able to track it down. I didn't do a real thorough search. I have a question that you probably can't handle, but since I'm waiting for my three-week interval to get an ENT appointment, I have an apnea machine, but I also have an occasional earache, and it seems like maybe one just brings out the other or something. So my sinuses are pressurized, and my middle ear seems to be hurting a bit. So,
and that would, in fact, be more noticeable if the pressure of your CPAP is, you know, influencing the way your ear feels. So there is potentially some connection there.
Right. I had it looked at cursorily and then got the appointment, but I'm just wondering.
The very easiest way to figure out if everything is open is to simply hold your nose and then close your mouth and blow.
Mm-hmm.
Most individuals can, you know, I think the term is pop their ears. If you can do that, what you've done is you simply pushed air from your nose all the way back up to your eardrum,
mm-hmm.
back through the sinuses, up the eustachian tube,
right.
into the middle ear, and up against the eardrum. And the movement of the eardrum is what we refer to as the pop. So if you can do that very, very easily, then we know that that entire system is open and that you're not creating any high or low pressure areas in there that could make you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
If you can't easily do that, then there's usually some type of physical obstruction somewhere between your nose and your eardrum. And that can be in the nasal passage, it can be in the sinus, it can be in the eustachian tube, it can be in the middle ear. And at that point, you need to figure out what's causing it.
If I might follow up, the eustachian tube would qualify as part of the middle ear. What if you had a mild puncture in an eardrum and you were trying to do that, and you couldn't obviously then pop your eardrum because do you think you would be able to notice something then, or if you're...
Most of the time, people are aware if they have a perforation in the eardrum, yes.
But I mean, and how do you know that?
Well, in most instances, we look.
Yeah.
You should be able to physically see it.
A basic look at the... All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm. We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. If you have a healthcare question for yourself or someone in your family, call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those persons who doesn't seem to be allergic to eggs, but always has a reaction to a flu shot, like weakening my resistance and having sort of like flu for a long period of time when normally I don't have the flu. What else could be in the flu shot that would influence me in that way?
I'm not aware of any other ingredients in the injection itself that have caused
Well, I have a lot of allergies also. You know, my doctors just tell me, well, keep everybody around you healthy.
That's right.
Don't take them. So, and I've been very, very fortunate in not having the flu for a long, long time. But every year I say, well, should I take it and risk it? But when I do, then I just have this reaction to it. And and my doctors say, well, just don't take it.
And make sure everybody around you does.
Right, yeah, and my rest of the family does.
Well, that's very nice of them.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Now, it is true, probably don't want to say this because, you know, people, it's not what people want to hear, but it actually is true that you could get a flu shot and you could still get the flu.
You can get immunized for any illness or disease
and still get it.
The illness or disease. There are no 100% effective immunizations for anything. What we can do is significantly put the odds in your favor of not getting the illness by immunizing not only you, but again, everybody around you. There is a critical mass at which point you can significantly reduce the spread of a particular illness by simply not having that little chain of human contact to spread it from one to the other.
And is the flu, is this an airborne thing like with a rhinovirus?
Yes.
It is. So,
yes.
So they're being around other people who may be coughing and sneezing and just breathing is potentially going to expose you. And it is also a thing where tops of tables,
yes,
door handles, all kinds of stuff like that that people have touched, it could be on there. You could touch it. And you get it.
And I think this is one of the areas where the more pervasive use of hand sanitizers really is kind of beneficial, in that before you put your hands toward your face, make sure they're clean. Now, you can do the same thing with just soap and water. But if you know, if you're out and about, you're shopping or something like that, having those little antiseptic towelettes or the little pump spray bottles to wash your hands, I think that's a very reasonable thing to do to minimize your chances of picking up stuff that is, in fact, out there.
So we're still reminding people that one of the easy things that you can do to try to keep yourself from getting sick over the wintertime is wash your hands.
The Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals, national organization looking at safety, and in one of their major, major points is just that, getting everybody to wash their hands.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's still very important.
All right. We certainly have time, a couple minutes here, if people want to give us a call. Again, the number, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As I mentioned the other day, we were talking to this physician, and we ended up spending a fair amount of time talking about the C-reactive protein. His thing is that a lot of illness is caused by having an overactive immune system. Now, I'm not exactly sure how to evaluate that, but his argument was, in fact, well, one of the things we've talked about this morning, Alzheimer's disease. And also arthritis, those things where, and perhaps there is some inflammation going on in the body, and that's why, you know, one of the things you look at is the C-reactive protein. Well, so his thing was that there are a lot of things, particularly things that we associate with aging, are the result, he says, of an overactive immune system. And his idea is that, well, what you really want to do is actually keep your immune system kind of calm. And, you know, like a lot of people, he has his 10-point plan to do that. And I guess the one thing that I would say about it was, I think if you followed his 10-point plan, you couldn't hurt yourself, and it probably would be not bad, because they were very basic things like make sure you're getting good sleep, have a good quality diet, have some exercise, have good significant personal relationships in your life, do things like meditation, you know, and try to maintain a positive emotional outlook. All these sorts of things, and you'd have to say, well, can't exactly argue with any of that.
I don't think anybody's going to be hurt by that.
No, that's right. You could do it, and you know, maybe even if he's wrong, you could do that, and you're still going to be okay. I guess I'm just interested in your reaction to the general idea that illnesses, diseases, chronic sorts of problems that people might have would have something to do with having an overactive immune system.
Well, it's not so much perhaps an overactive immune system as it's an inappropriately activated immune system.
Okay.
Because we do have some very well-defined medical conditions that fall into a category of what we call autoimmune inflammatory diseases. And what has happened is some biochemical trigger has activated the body's immune system not against an outside threat, which is really what our immune system is for, to protect us against external disease, but something that occurred internally that for other people seems to be pretty normal, but in susceptible individuals seems to trigger this immune response where the body then activates inflammation, other immune mechanisms, and turns out to attack the body itself, which is obviously not a good thing. And so we do have evidence that there are particular diseases that follow this particular mechanism. Whether this underlies lots of other chronic medical diseases, to my knowledge right now, just isn't known. I mean, I think it's an interesting area to look at, and certainly the things that you mentioned that might be beneficial. There's certainly no harm in doing that. I'm not going to argue that at all.
And for those, let's just real quick to turn it around, for those people who think that maybe as a way of trying to keep themselves healthy, or to if they get sick, to help their body to fight that off, are there things that you think actually can boost the functioning of the immune system so that, for example, that you don't get sick, or if you get sick, you get well more quickly? Well,
the things you specifically mentioned are very, very true. If you are stressed and you're not getting enough sleep, you're eating the wrong things, you're drinking the wrong thing, not getting the exercise, if you find yourself socially isolated, those are all characteristics that are going to contribute to, one, becoming ill, and two, not recovering as fast.
Yeah, all right. Well, there we got to leave it for this time around. 2 months, Dr. Jeff will be back. In the meantime, we want to thank him, Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.